Hello, everyone. It's Molly Wood. Welcome back to Make Me Smart Tuesday edition, our deep dive into one topic with, you know, several other topics sprinkled in and about with one expert guest. I'm here with Kimberly Adams, who's in for Kai all week. Hooray. And today on the show, hello. Today on the show, we're going to talk about income inequality, which somebody on Twitter, actually, when I previewed this, almost immediately corrected me, which should not surprise you because Twitter, but noted that in some cases, what we're really talking about is wealth inequality, because when you get to a certain point, you transcend the idea of income. But we are going to put this actually today, I think, in a context that is not so much about politics or economics, but as a national security problem.
Yeah, I was going to say I often phrase it as economic inequality, but then you just said we're not going to phrase it so much in economics and politics, so I don't really know what to do with that.
Well, it's both, right? Because it's a national security problem, it's all of those.
Yeah, but wealth inequality specifically is more extreme than at just about any other point in our history. We have all these comparisons to the Gilded Age, you know. And this inequality was true even before the pandemic, but now you add in 30 million people without a job in the U.S. and 43 million, as you pointed out in the PM show yesterday, are at risk of eviction this month alone, which is just wild.
Yep. And listen, like in political and economic terms, wealth inequality is largely what has gotten us to the political climate that we are in today. And if you have studied history, you know that this particular situation with this degree of inequality globally and in a single country is not always, but often a predictor of a vast upheaval in a society. It's led to revolutions in the past. It has led to the rise of authoritarian governments. And in some cases, those upheavals have themselves led to good change, but via a tough path. So what we want to do is sort of have a conversation in which we talk about how much of a threat inequality really is to our country, to our democracy, to our politics, and how where we might be on this timeline in this current moment.
So to help make us all smart about this, our guest today is George Packer. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic, also an author and a playwright and a gardener. And George, thanks so much for coming on Make Me Smart.
I hope you guys make me smart today.
That's your job. It's like a team effort. Yes. Well, none of us is as smart as all of us.
So what you don't know, because you weren't listening to our pre-show, dear audience, is that right before we started the show, we were talking about the eternal problem of collard greens, chard, and I'll add other greens, which is that they take up a ton of space in the fridge and then they cook down dramatically. To nothing. And it's really hard to figure out what to season and what to do. And then George came up with this phrase, because the man is nothing if not a writer, radical reduction, which I feel like, George, seems like it could be, could serve as a useful metaphor for us in this conversation.
Let's see if we can connect collard greens with inequality. There is a radical inequality between the green as it grows and the green as it cooks. And let's one of you is going to have to do this. I can't. Let's go from to the topic of the day.
So please.
That was very impressive. That was very impressive. I'm not going to try to stretch that metaphor much further.
Nah,
but
we're done.
Specifically,
we're done with that
George,
one, but
can you lay out where we are in terms of inequality in this country, just sort of in the moment, and put it in the historical context for us?
It's been getting worse for the past maybe 45 years. It began to widen. Income inequality and wealth inequality, which are different but related, they began to widen in the 70s after a period of about four decades in which we had unprecedented economic equality in this country, really from the 30s and the World War II period into the 70s. We were maybe the most economically equal country in history up to that point. And there were lots of reasons why: government policy, the New Deal, the effects of government spending in World War II, pretty much the end of a lot of global competition. We were the number one economy in the world by a mile for decades. In the 70s, it began to change with technological change, with globalization, with the rise of foreign competition. And that change has been creating wider and wider gaps in income and wealth ever since. And it, nothing seems to stop it. Neither a Democratic president nor Republican president, neither a boom nor a bust, neither peace nor war. It just keeps on growing. There was one period under Bill Clinton in the late 90s when the economy itself grew so quickly that incomes across the board grew for Black Americans, for white Americans, working class, middle class. But that was just a very short period. And really the rule ever since I was a kid in the 70s has been the rich keep getting richer and the rest either are stagnating or get poorer.
What happened? I mean, here, you know, you described this sort of economic utopia, which I assume was not evenly distributed like so many things, right? You did have a rising middle class, but I assume it was not across race. I assume it was not equal across gender.
It was definitely not. And race and gender are the key factors to look at when you're analyzing that period, that post-war period when the middle class grew so fast. Equality actually was rising across all groups, but it rose faster for white Americans, and the highest incomes got higher, but they didn't get higher very fast. And that's partly because of taxation. I mean, taxes on upper incomes were, in the Eisenhower years, were like 70 or 80%. I mean, numbers that we can't even imagine today. There was also just a boom in job creation, and there was strong unions, which is a key part of this, strong unions that were able to bargain for higher wages, and those unions remained strong into the 70s. I think everything changed in the 70s. Unions got weaker. The rich began to get richer with deregulation and with cutting of taxes during the Reagan years, and the working class began to really fall behind. And also the post-industrial economy made a big difference because suddenly you needed a college degree in order to have a chance at a good income in life. Whereas before, there was a path for at least for male Americans from high school to a factory job to a decent living, which left you, you know, somewhere solidly in the middle class. That's just no longer true anymore either. So all these changes, economic, social, and political, began in the 70s. But I think the political one is the one we really need to look at, because inequality is terrible for democracy. That's sort of the bottom line of this conversation. It is not a healthy situation for a democratic society.
But why specifically? Because, I mean, for all of history, there have been haves and have-nots, poor people and wealthy people, through, you know, go back as far as you want. What is the particular threat to democracy today from inequality?
I'd say maybe it could be summed up in the word expectation. The public in a country like ours expects, or has come to expect, government to be responsive to its will. That is the point of democracy. It's sovereignty of the people. And in a society as radically unequal as ours has become, the broad public no longer can expect government to respond to its needs and its demands. A study was done a few years ago that showed that of the bills that pass Congress, ones with very little popular support, but that have the support of what you could call the plutocracy, the very rich, corporate America, are likelier to pass. Whereas the ones that have a lot of public support, but not the support of the 1%, and corporate America are very unlikely to pass. So that study made it really clear that our representative system is actually breaking down because concentrations of money create concentrations of political power, which in the end alienate large parts of the public that don't feel as if they're represented any longer by the government. And that is a debilitating, a really devastating, kind of corrosive effect on a democratic society. And that's what we've been living with really for 30 or 40 years.
So to put a fine point on it, you're saying that at some point it's really a question of power, and that even if, you know, I was having this argument actually with my financial advisor, not surprisingly, And I said, it seems to me that this is also perception. It is a sense of fairness. So that even if people, sure, have enough to eat, that that's not our baseline here. That when you come to a point where people feel powerless, that is when you get this kind of revolutionary mindset.
Exactly. I'd hesitate at the word revolutionary because it doesn't automatically become that. It can have right. all kinds of different effects. But you're absolutely right that the mindset is not, I'm hungry and therefore something is wrong. The mindset is, I'm doing everything I'm supposed to do and I still am falling behind while these other people, this is inequality, it's relative, it's by watching how other people are doing. These other people seem to be cutting corners, often even cheating and breaking the rules and continuing to get ahead, which means that they have politicians in their pocket. Whether or not this is true across the board, it's an incredibly widespread perception among Americans that government has become corrupt. Politicians are in the pockets of well-heeled interest groups, and the ordinary person no longer has a voice in power. And that's a dangerous, volatile state of affairs.
Which leads to a point that I've been seeing crop up in a bunch of different articles and think pieces, including some of your own, that inequality is in some ways a national security threat.
I think it weakens us in all kinds of ways. And it's really not a coincidence that the period of the Second Gilded Age, as it's sometimes called, of the past 40 years, coincides with the decline of America relative to other countries as a world power. So that today, and the pandemic has really been the litmus test for all of this, we see a lot of Asian countries doing better with regard to the pandemic. We see some European countries doing better. And we see no one looking to the United States for leadership, to lead a global coalition to try to contain and end this nightmare. And that's because we are no longer regarded as an example of democratic power. We are seen as increasingly, I think, as a kind of better off Brazil, where vast differences between the rich and the poor, corruption, breakdowns in government services are all becoming endemic. And so why would Taiwan or Vietnam or Denmark look to us for answers to the pandemic? So yeah, I think our decline on the world stage coincides with and is related to our decline as a middle-class democracy during these years of inequality.
So let's talk about revolution and alternatives there too. I don't know if that's a word. But historically, what tends to happen? Like what, you know, there it does seem to be that there are certain outcomes that are relatively predictable when you have wealth inequality at these levels and political unrest at these levels.
Sometimes, but not always. I think we have an assumption that when people look up at the rich getting richer and feel themselves falling behind, their automatic political move is to have a revolution. There are examples. Tsarist Russia was actually not the most unequal country in the world, but it was incredibly unequal compared to
leading up to the Bolshevik revolution.
Yeah. And so you could draw a connection between inequality and revolution in the case of Russia. In other cases, revolutions seem to come more often when there's actually rising expectations, when there might be a lower middle class or a middle class that's beginning to do better, and it isn't happening fast enough. That was the case, by the way, in Iran in the late 70s. Iran was not becoming a country of vast differences between rich and poor. It had been that, but there was actually a rising educated middle class that was the backbone of that revolution. So sometimes revolutions don't come when things are getting worse, but when things are getting slightly better. Another route that societies take, and maybe more often, especially today, is to look for a strong man, to look for an authoritarian leader who can solve the problem. Because when democratic institutions just don't respond to these demands, they're discredited in the eyes of the people, and democracy suddenly loses its power. And instead, people want a shortcut to a solution, which demagogues have a powerful way of offering. And so we see in this country, a demagogue as president who played very skillfully on the perception that the country had become unfair and corrupt. He said he was going to drain the swamp. He said he was going to get rid of the elites who were unfairly soaking up the country's wealth and power and laughing at the ordinary folks who were falling behind. Trump used all those demagogic tricks to convince the public that he was here to fix it. Of course, he wasn't. But in a situation like ours, and there are other examples around the world, that kind of authoritarian populist has a real appeal. Society is really vulnerable to that sort of appeal when people have lost faith in their institutions because they don't see them solving problems.
With acknowledgement that many people are going to take issue with your calling Trump a demagogue, I will sort of pull back at some of the central points that you're making and ask you to sort of talk about some other examples globally where, because a lot of the people, especially when I was out in 2016 reporting on the election, you know, nobody was out there saying, oh, Trump is appealing to my sense that our democracy doesn't work and therefore I'm looking for a strong man. They said he's the kind of guy who's going to get stuff done. And I'm wondering, because maybe that example is very personal for a lot of people, can you give us some more distant examples, like other places in the world where we're seeing inequality connected to the rise of people who might appeal to this narrative?
Right. Well, I think what you heard on the campaign trail is totally unsurprising, but it was Trump's aura as a strong man who said things you weren't supposed to say and who would break things in order to get stuff done that made him appealing. He was not an ordinary Democratic politician. And I think there are comparable examples in Brazil with Bolsonaro, in India with Modi, in the Philippines with Duterte. I don't know if in every one of those cases and some of the others around the world, if inequality was widening at the moment that those strongmen were elected. But there is a global perception that people's lives are not under their own control, that distant forces, whether it's corporations or foreigners or alien forces that have somehow taken over the elites in their own country and are controlling them. This is a widespread conspiratorial mindset that comes when you don't see progress in your own life, and when you see your government unresponsive and maybe indifferent to your fate, and a class growing that seems to have all the power and all the money. And so you turn to someone who says, hey, I'm one of you. I'm from the real people. We're going to get rid of these aliens. We're going to get rid of these elites because they're not real Brazilians, real Indians, real Americans. And we're going to return the country to the people. And that's the promise of the authoritarian populist. It never happens. He doesn't return the country to the people. He holds power for himself. But in desperate situations like have prevailed in some of these countries after decades of globalization and upheaval, it's easy to trust or to believe because the alternatives have failed. There is a third way.
Great. No, that's what I was going to say, is like what often happens then is you also have a divided populace because, you know, scarcity breeds division. These arguments are easy to make. How do you come to solutions? So, yes, hit us with the third way. This seems hopeful.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Because before we get to the hopeful part, let's stick with the radical reduction.
Yeah, we still have to stair step to disaster first and then we'll come out.
Yeah.
Radical.
But it's true that
radical reduction.
That economic inequality often coincides with political polarization as society starts to sort into more extreme groups that each see the other as the problem and as incompatible with the good of the country or a decent future. And that has certainly happened in this country. If you graft, and I've seen these graphs, if you graft the rise of inequality in this country and graft polarization by voting patterns and congressional sorting, et cetera, you'll see that they're almost exactly the same line. They've grown in this at the same time, at the same rate. I think the solution that we have had in the past in this country has been reform. And there really are two or three periods in particular. When inequality becomes so great that people start to lose faith in democracy, they, from below, they put pressure on their leaders and organize and mobilize and create changes. It happened at the beginning of the 20th century during the Gilded Age when the progressive movement began to change the way elections happened, to pass food and drug legislation and antitrust legislation and all kinds of piecemeal reforms that were designed to redistribute power away from the trusts, which as they were called back then, back toward the people and their legislatures, which had fallen under the power of the trust. So, and then the second was the New Deal, when in the depths of the worst depression we've ever seen, Roosevelt enacted sweeping legislation that essentially rewrote the social contract so that risk was transferred from the individual to the collective, and in the form of Social Security, collective bargaining power, workman's compensation, and all kinds of other laws that we've now been living with for 80, 90 years. Some of them have grown a little bit atrophied from lack of use, but we do have a history in this country of turning to reform through democratic means in order to mitigate. We don't end inequality, but to mitigate its worst excesses so that in the end, the public's faith in democracy can be restored. And that's, I think we're facing that moment right now. And the question is whether it will happen again.
Okay. George Packer, a staff writer at The Atlantic, also an author and playwright. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Thanks, George. Take good care.
Okay. Have a good day, everybody.
I'm straight up and shamelessly stealing this from Erica Phillips, but with credit, because credit matters. We want to thank George for boiling it down for us today.
Oh.
I know.
Boiling it down. Well done,
it's
Erica.
Like collard greens. Oh, she's so good. I love it. All right. We are headed to a break, but before we go, we do want to hear your thoughts. You can, of course, send an email or a voice memo to makemesmart@marketplace.org, and we will be back with a news fix.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews, and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes every Sunday wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, news fix time. Welcome back.
Yes. I know. That was a lot to think about, and we didn't really digest it, but yeah. But so if we have any thoughts.
Well, then let's take a second.
Let's take a second. I think we should give ourselves a moment.
Because.
And say, what do we think about the third way?
It seems to be what's happening, right? We are having this moment of people just not believing anymore that our current system is working for them. And. Mm-hmm. This new level of engagement on issues of civil rights, on issues of economic inequality. I mean, Dion Raboen, who writes for Axios and sometimes comes on Marketplace, he had this this mention in his newsletter about the K-shaped recovery coming out of the pandemic that's really stuck mm-hmm. with me, because everybody was looking for the V-shaped recovery, and instead it's a K-shaped recovery where you have one line going up because the rich are getting richer coming out of this, and the other line going down, the poor are getting poorer. And yeah, that makes me wonder which of these routes we're going to end up taking.
I'm actually going to say, with all due respect to Dion, that I'm pretty sure he got that from our show. Because our guy Wesley tweeted me about the K-shaped recovery, and we talked about it on Make Me Smart. And I was like, have you ever heard of this? I'm looking up Wesley because I want to get his name right, because credit matters.
Yes.
But yeah.
Who knows? Maybe he linked back to it in the newsroom.
Maybe. But Wesley actually tweeted me the other day, and he was like, now that everyone's talking about this, I just want to make it clear that this was me on Make Me Smart. And I'm like, it was, dude. We got you.
Okay. Well, there we go. There we go.
But no, I mean, and also, I believe it has existed before, so Dion is super smart. But that is ultimately what it comes down to. I think, like, it is the impact of the revelation, right, of everybody realizing this. It is a question of whether everybody realizes it, how many people realize it, how many people still are stuck in a cycle of blaming someone else. I just finished Robert Reich's book, which is pretty straightforward on this topic, the system, who rigged it, and how to fix it. But he makes that point frequently, that it is division, that only in coming together can these reforms happen, that, right, that only by coalition can reforms occur, and division is also this defining characteristic of America right now. And so I think the question really is, like, do we overcome the divisions to fight the real enemy, which is, like, wealth and power, or not? And that seems to decide historically the fate of a country.
But that's just it. Wealth and power doesn't have to be the enemy. It's in right. our current setup, people holding on to wealth and power to the disadvantage of those who don't have it is the issue.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, no, exactly. The existence of wealth is not in itself mm-hmm. evil. And this was the argument I was having with my financial advisor. It's the fairness question. It's who has the power. It is this question about, I mean, I think, I actually think George Packer put it perfectly in that idea of disenfranchisement, that, like, that the politic, the democracy is damaged when people do not believe that the officials they've elected to represent them actually represent them. And that mm-hmm. fundamentally that's where it becomes this threat to democracy, which I thought was super interesting.
Yeah. All right. Let's start with your news fix.
Okay. So we have talked a lot on the show about hate speech. And actually, interestingly, there was a piece today, if Brazil is a country to look at in terms of when these forces can occur. There was a piece today that said that Brazil's sort of online trolls are now taking to the real world, forming roving groups of basically militia members. Anyway, so we've talked about the consequences that hate speech can have in the real world and how much platforms are doing to prevent this. The ADL, Anti-Defamation League, had a piece just yesterday saying that, you know, despite Facebook's efforts, despite the audit by civil rights groups, despite its claims about what it's doing, they put up a report saying these are all of the places in which hate speech and misinformation still propagate and thrive. And I am and that's not particularly surprising, but I wanted to pair it with this really interesting piece on current affairs, which is it says the truth is paywalled, but the lies are free. Because mm-hmm. this is something that I brought up on Twitter a few weeks ago, this idea that it's just part of an ongoing conversation about how do we deal with platforms that, you know, give us a free product in exchange for our data. And the answer is always like, oh, well, you should just pay. And that is both regressive and potentially dangerous, because as many people have pointed out, that puts you in a situation where good information costs money and bad mm-hmm. information, you know, everybody, if you're poor, if you're elderly, like what you're left with is bad information. And this piece points out that that is sort of already the case, that you have a point. Yeah. You're at a point now where if you don't have a Financial Times subscription, you get,
which is hundreds and hundreds of dollars,
you get InfoWars, you know, or you get Facebook. I interrupted you.
Yeah.
What were you gonna say?
No, I mean, it was just it's expensive. I was sitting on a panel with a bunch of other business journalists once, and I was just like, look, you know, at Marketplace, it's free. It goes on the radio. We try to make it accessible for everybody because we're one of the few sources of business news that does not live behind some sort of paywall. You either have to have a cable subscription, or you have to have a newspaper subscription or digital news subscription. And so that, you know, that means that people who are already doing well financially get advice and information to do better financially. And everyone else, you know, we do the best we can. And so that's something worth, you know, as we think about the business model of journalism, which is under strain in the best of times and even now more so in the pandemic. It has, when the business model of journalism is struggling, it has real consequences for the rest of society in terms of who gets access to information and who falls victim to misinformation campaigns. So,
right. And that's ultimately, I don't want it to be self-serving about journalism. It is really a question about who is targeted with this, with misinformation campaigns, and how can we battle that? Yes.
Yeah, but with fairness, there is some community journalism efforts that are going on that are trying to alleviate just this. So, I mean, like, we're not the end-all be-all on this. My news fix is related to this crazy situation in Beirut that was breaking even just this afternoon, where there was this huge explosion, and, like, it looks real bad over there. But it brings to mind, now we don't know what the cause of this explosion was yet, but it brings to mind the fact that Lebanon has just been going through this insane economic crisis. Their currency just falling off a cliff, hyperinflation, and this has been going on for a long time. People are only getting a couple of hours of electricity per day in a lot of places. I have a good friend who's a Lebanese expat, and she's been freaking out about this for months because her parents, you know, who are there, they can't access any of their money. The bank, like, won't give it to them. And so they're struggling. And she would like to send them money, but she doesn't have any confidence that if she wires the money that the bank will even give it to them, or that it will hold any value long enough for her to go and buy them to go and buy things. And, you know, it's a bad situation. I think we're going to probably hear a lot more about Lebanon in the next couple of days as people look into this. But I have some articles in the show notes that I think are good primers that, to what's been happening there.
Yeah, the explosion looks extremely bad. And to your point, too, this is how the BBC puts it. The country's economic collapse is reigniting old tensions. And it really does point to how we think that these things are unrelated, right? We think that anger and hate and division are unrelated to economic tension or economic policy or just money in general. And in fact, they're really, really, really of a piece. And also, this looks terrible. This explosion.
Okay.
Okay, I'm going to stop clicking. And that is it for the news fix. Let's do the mailbag.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
Okay, last week's episode was about hate speech online and its offline consequences. And Molly, you and Kai had Andrew Marantz of The Amazing Last Name on the show for that conversation. Mm-hmm. Listener Don Locker wrote in to share his perspective on the issue. He writes, I listen to Make Me Smart and most of the Marketplace podcasts, and I hear lots of talk about the difficulty that social media platforms have with monitoring speech. Often what is mentioned is that it is difficult to do with algorithms for various reasons. In the past, you used to talk about how profitable tech companies are over traditional companies because they are able to produce so much with so few employees. Maybe social media companies need more employees. These employees could be used as moderators. Algorithms are flawed, and so are people, but people can be held accountable and are able to understand nuance. Perhaps there should be some combination of employees and algorithms.
Definitely. We actually, this is the part where I'm going to try to remember a thing on the fly. But on Marketplace Tech, we did an interview about this. A study came out that essentially said if Facebook really wants to get serious about this, at a minimum, they need to double their number of moderators and bring them in-house, not have them be contractors.
Yeah, that's what I noticed. He kept saying employees. And the thing is, often this stuff gets contracted out to people who aren't employees and often who don't have the benefits or the pay and are doing this incredibly hard work.
And originally, and you know, they've gotten a little bit better about this, but for example, they weren't in the countries where these things were happening. Like, we know that in Myanmar, for example, Facebook was, inciting actual violence, and Facebook didn't have any experts or even native speakers necessarily on the ground. This gets to the question that you hear these platforms say all the time. This is a really complicated problem. It's a really hard thing to solve. It's, almost impossible to do at scale. And I would love to see what a company with nearly unlimited funding can actually accomplish at scale. I'm with you, buddy.
They got a lot of money.
Last week on What Do You Want to Know Wednesday, Erica Phillips asked us, we're going to just take a total shift in tone here. Erica Phillips asked us what we were snacking on. Yes, exactly, because we need a lift. And Kai, bless, said fruit. That's his big splurge. And I said cheese sticks and apples, but only because I've been working at home for 4 years and that's just like I got a system. Anyway, a couple of you wrote in to let us know what you are snacking on, including a voice memo from Ivan Hymanen.
Hi, Kai and Molly and Kimberly. This is Ivan from Brooklyn, New York. At the start of the quarantine, I, like probably a lot of other people, thought that I was going to go off the grid. I was going to hunt my own game and grow my own mushrooms and grind my own coffee and bake my own bread. Well, about 100 failed sourdough starters later, my snack of choice has just happened upon me, and that is pancakes fried up from the very failed starters. You just pour them straight out of the jar onto a sizzling pan. You add maybe some scallions, maybe some tomatoes, and you eat a whole one for yourself at 2 in the afternoon, and then you pass out for 10 hours. Love the show. Bye.
I love Ivan. I would like regular culinary updates. No, God, no. Nope, I refuse. I had a whole rant about how I will not do it. It's disgusting. I'm not feeding my food. It's so gross. Blah.
I mean, plants are one thing. Do you eat meat?
Like a goat. I know. But I mean, like, it's just a literal food that sits in the fridge and needs to be fed. I tried it. No, it's just upsetting.
It's like Audrey 2 from Little Shop of Horrors.
That's exactly what I think every time. Feed me, Seymour.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay, I was worried you weren't going to get the reference. Whew,
oh,
that
yeah.
was a close
no,
one.
I'm, okay. I'm right there with you. Mind melds.
All right. Okay, and so we're going to end with the Make Me Smart question. This week, our answer comes from Anna McLawhorn, and here's what she sent in.
Hi, Kai and Molly. This is Anna from Santa Rosa, California. I'm calling about something I thought I knew for sure and found out later I was wrong. I own a yoga studio. We've been in business for almost 11 years, and I thought I was in the healthiest business you could possibly be in. And with the COVID-19 crisis and how we need to be conducting ourselves to be safe and healthy, it turns out that the yoga business is one of the least healthy things that we could be doing, getting into enclosed spaces and focusing on breathing, being together for extended period of time. And we've had to make transitions. We've had to pivot onto Zoom. And another thing I thought I knew for sure is that Zoom could never be a good way to get a yoga practice done. Luckily, we found that it is a way we can stay in touch, that we can take the hour out of our day and focus on our breathing, focus on our bodies, focus on the good things in our life that are still here, even amid the crisis that we're all going through. Thanks for doing your show. I feel smarter every time I listen.
And I feel smarter listening to her. That's great.
She has a great voice.
Very much so.
That is it. I want her and Ivan to call us back with regular updates because I need culinary tips and also breathing exercises. Okay, thanks.
Please.
That's it for today's show. Don't forget to subscribe to our newsletter at marketplace.org/newsletters. Also, of course, send your questions for tomorrow to makemesmart@marketplace.org. Subject line questions. Ethan Peretz is all over that. And we'll see you then.
Okay. Make Me Smart is produced by Sam Anderson. And the digital producer is Tony Wagner. I feel like I jumped on that. Ben Hethcote is our video producer. And Ethan Peretz, who you just mentioned, is our video intern. And thanks to writer-producer Erica Phillips.
You totally didn't. But that guy did the analysis of how we start whenever we want with our last music. Today's program was engineered by Charlton Thorpe, who is going to choose how long the music goes right now, mixed by Garrett Lang. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez, and the executive director of On Demand and senior producer this week is, and she's getting the rockin' tunes, Sitara Nieves.
Well, she's a rockin' character.
We got the long one. She is a rockin' character. That is really true. It's really true.
Yes.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.